Hey, this is Matt Markin, and we are now at episode 43 of the Adventures in Advising podcast. The state of Connecticut has implemented a guided pathways model for its community college system with a large investment in case management to support those pathways. How does this go from an idea to actual implementation? Find out here. And if you don't already, check us out on social media, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and TikTok at Advising Podcast and YouTube at Adventures in Advising. Without further ado, here's the episode.
Hello and welcome to episode 43 of Adventures in Advising. It's our 18th episode of 2021.
Let's give some shout outs. Shout out to Amy Soto, who works at the University Advisement Center at BYU. Amy reached out on LinkedIn and said, "Hi, Matt, I really enjoy your podcast and the great content that you are sharing. Thanks for all that you do." Thank you, Amy, for your comment and also listening in to the podcast. We truly appreciate it.
Thanks to Julia Maher for getting in touch to let us know that she really enjoyed episode 41 of the podcast. Julia said, "I really connected to Sarah's words about work-life balance and career, and Ebony's discussion of the importance of relationships and collaborations. Also, her talk about work-life balance and being realistic about what you can do. Really glad that that connected with you, Julia, and thanks again for getting in touch to let us know."
And also regarding episode 41 with Ebony Staten, Ebony, you got a lot of love from some of your former colleagues. Mauricio Kadavid from Cal State San Bernardino wrote, "Ebony Staten was always sunshine and rainbows whenever I interacted with her." And one of her peer advisors, Wendy Padrone, who wrote, "I have nothing but amazing memories interacting with Ebony." So wonderful sentiments from both of you. Ebony is definitely one of a kind.
Up first, it's Gail Barrett and Michael Buccelli.
So the state of Connecticut is implementing a guided pathways model for its community college system, and they are utilizing a case management advising model to support guided pathways. So this episode is devoted to learning about the history of how this guided pathways model came about, what is guided pathway model, how case management is being used, and kind of how it's all being implemented. So to get us started with learning more about the history of this and how an idea goes through this process to where it is now, we have two special guests. So first up is Michael Buccelli, who serves as Associate Vice President for Student Success Management for the Connecticut State Community Colleges. He brings with him 18 years experience developing, leading, and delivering high quality programs and services in workforce development, enrollment management, and student affairs in community-based organizations and community colleges. He has held leadership roles in academic advising, career services, counseling, holistic support services, disability services, and veterans affairs. Prior to his AVP role, he served as a guided pathways manager at the Connecticut State Colleges and Universities, leading several redesign efforts, including the creation of the holistic case management advising policy. He has presented nationally on a variety of topics, such as advising redesign and first-year experience. He holds a BS from the University of Vermont, MSW in management from Southern Connecticut State University, and is a doctoral candidate at Central Connecticut State University in the Educational Leadership Program. Michael, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
And we also have Dr. Gail Barrett, who is currently the Associate Vice President of Enrollment and Retention Services for Connecticut State Community College. Dr. Barrett has over 20 years of experience working in higher education and is skilled in areas such as enrollment management, holistic student support, guided pathways, and student development. She has presented nationally on such topics as holistic case management, advising models, and the backwards design of first-year experience courses. Dr. Barrett has been with the Connecticut Community College System since 2008 and has served in various roles such as Nursing Admissions Specialist, Director of Admissions, and Director of Enrollment Management. In spring 2018, Dr. Barrett joined the CSCU Student Success Center in their work on guided pathways. As a guided pathways manager, she has co-led for the Holistic Student Support Redesign Team. Through this work, she helped to co-create the Holistic Case Management Advising Policy. Dr. Barrett received her bachelor's degree in psychology from Stonehill College, a master's degree in counselor education from Central Connecticut State University, and her doctorate in educational leadership from the University of Hartford. Her research on mentoring networks and women community college leaders was recently published in the Journal of Applied Research in the Community College. Dr. Barrett, welcome to the podcast as well.
Thank you so much, and please call me Gail.
Well, we are delighted to have the opportunity to chat to you both, and this is a really interesting topic, and there's going to be lots to delve into, but we really do like to give our listeners the opportunity to get to know you a little bit, at least at the beginning, and obviously very distinguished bios, but if you could tell us just a little bit in terms of like finding your way into higher ed and where you are now. Was higher ed always a passion? Was that where you always saw yourself ending up, or how did it come about?
I guess I'll start. So for me, it was kind of a happy accident. I was doing an internship my senior year of college, and I was interpreting the strong interest inventory for entering college freshmen. And I found that I really liked working with college students, even though I was still one myself. And from that point on, I worked with my supervisor in the career counseling office at Stonehill, who suggested I look into college admissions as my first career. So I started off as a very green admissions counselor at Post University and kind of worked my way through various admissions and enrollment and student development roles until, you know, here I am today.
And I love that you discovered the passion for working with college students, and you've managed to get to a point where you're making a real difference at a strategic level, which we'll delve into. I suppose, Mike, what about you? How did you find yourself where you are now?
Yeah, thank you. My career really comes full circle right now. I have the privilege and pleasure of leading the implementation of this holistic case management advising model. And, I was my undergraduate and graduate degrees in social work. I began my career at a nonprofit community-based agency called Women and Family Centers. And in that role, I was asked by the then CEO if I would help manage a workforce development program that they had that was really kind of on its last couple dollars. my job was to recruit 10 students, help them complete their GED, and get into a certified nurse's assistant program. It was a case management model. I was able to get those 10 students and grow that program over a 5-year period. We were serving upwards over 150 students. When I started thinking, you know what? We're getting students through these workforce credentials. They're getting employed, but they're still not making family-sustaining wages. And to me, I saw the associate's and bachelor's degree really as the gateway to family-sustainable wage. So I started thinking about, where could I go? And started applying for positions in the community college system. And I often use the analogy, I was pushing these rafts across the river to the other side, and they were getting to the credit side and starting in developmental ed. And I'd see my caseload, the students around the city, and ask them how things were going. And oftentimes they struggled and kind of spun out in developmental ed and didn't get to that associate goal. So I applied for and was hired as the director of career services at Gateway Community College in New Haven. During that time, Dean of Students, Wilson Luna, and gave me some opportunities to help reimagine their new student advising program. So I worked closely with the faculty advising director at the time and student affairs folks to think about how we would better onboard students in an advising context. That led me to leadership roles in advising and counseling and student affairs at Gateway. Come to 2018, actually early in 2017, we were attending a conference and we're learning all about holistic student supports, and the IPASS grantees were presenting, and we were just getting all juiced up. And the folks we traveled with kind of looked at me and said, Mike, do you think you could lead this kind of on the side while you do your other job? And I said, no, I said, this is a full-time job. If you really want to redesign this, it's going to take, more than a couple hours a week. This will probably segue into some of your next questions, but that kind of emerged as a concept that we would have full-time faculty, staff, administrators step away from their roles on campus to really lead this work. And flash forward to today, when I talked to the new staff who were onboarding at Housatonic Community College or Middlesex Community College or Northwestern Community College, I tell them that story that I could never in my wildest dreams have imagined that we would be able to deliver a case management model to all community college students in Connecticut. I saw the need the first day I stepped on the campus. I saw students in line. I saw frustration. I saw students not knowing where to go, not because the folks weren't working hard in those offices, just because there was three counselors for 7,000 students, right? And that just by virtue of the sheer numbers and how understaffed those offices were, we couldn't even dream of a case management model. And then here we are today, and we'll talk to you throughout this interview about how we got to approval of that policy and then subsequent implementation.
Yeah, I like the analogy with the raft and the river. But yes, great segue. And I think you gave a great kind of foundation in terms of what this episode's going to be about. And, you know, thank you both again for being here. And it's nice to kind of get your backgrounds in higher ed. And I guess let's talk about that. You know, you kind of alluded to kind of the start of how this came about, but can you talk more about how the idea regarding creating a holistic advising approach, the guided pathways, reducing caseloads, like kind of how this all started?
I mean, I'll just say my own personal experience. I'll never forget my first day at Middlesex Community College. I was the admissions director, and I walked in, and there was literally a line around the corner of the admissions office, and it was like, welcome to college, here's your desk, here's a line of students that need to be advised. And I don't think I had even put my purse down at that moment. It was just really literally walking in the door, hitting the ground running. And it struck me even from my first day that, you know, this doesn't work. This is a very transactional, you know, in and out. What classes do you need? What's your placement test scores? Here's your schedule, on your way. Because we were not appropriately staffed at that time to really have the really meaningful relationship we wanted to develop with students. So in the admissions office, when I was there, we were the de facto new student advisors, which, you know, even from my scope as not a full-time advisor, I spent my first summer not doing my admissions director job, but advising because we needed to have students get classes. And, you know, even then it really struck me that, you know, we're not doing this right. And it's not because people don't care. And it's not because we don't want to do it right. It's because we don't have the resources to do it right. So when I got the call to come on board and work on this, I was slightly terrified. But again, it was one of those happy accidents in my own career where it was the opportunity to really take what I knew wasn't working from personal experience and take the opportunity and take the golden ticket and really make it better, not just at my institution, but at all 12. So that was what really appealed to me about this work, the ability to make a potential, you know, life-changing experience for students, and also making sure that we were staffing our colleges appropriately to provide those experiences to students.
And yeah, Michael, and I can expand upon that a little bit too. You know, the touching back on that first kind of conversation in 2017, there had been work going on in Connecticut around guided pathways for several years before that. The Student Success Center was established thanks to funding through Jobs for the Future. And that entity had kind of brought folks together and brought in best practices and ideas. And it was good. It was sharing those ideas out, but it really took dedicated staff to do the planning and development work. And, you know, Gail and I were asked to lead what was then called support architecture. So we established through the Success Center three separate architectures: choice architecture, recruitment architecture, and support architecture. So two faculty members stepped away from their full-time roles to lead choice architecture. Recruitment was led by our system director of financial aid, a director of admissions, and a director of workforce development. A dean of workforce development. And Gail and I to lead support architecture. So that really, and above the three architectures lived a guided pathways task force, again, cross kind of discipline, cross-functional, and included some president and CEO, cabinet members from the colleges, faculty, staff. And that task force was really the parent structure above those three architectures.
Well, Sam, we were very lucky. It was the opportunity really of a lifetime from a professional career standpoint to really take this, what everyone knew what wasn't working, and really build it And Mike and I were very fortunate in the fact that we built, I think at the time it was capped around a 40 member team for Holistic Student Support Redesign. And it was membership across all 12 colleges. So you had advisors at all 12 colleges who were like, thank you for working on this, because we know that you're listening to what we actually need to do to better service our students. So we had advisors, we had career counselors, faculty, administrators, librarians, you name it. We had all different voices from across the 12 college campuses to really weigh in on their own experiences to help us really design a model that made sense. So it was slightly terrifying, but very exciting at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, and the other thing is when we talk with some of, you know, the leading institutions around the country who've done this work, they've done it on the fly. They've done it taking those 5 and 10 hours away from their other work. And when we describe our story to some of those folks, they say, wow, like we had, you know, a team of 7 of us who were able to be focused on this solely. And that allowed us, you know, we put in our time, too. We visited every single campus and presented on guided pathways as a concept. We talked to them about the other work that was going on around the country. We partnered up too. We had many great national partners who came to the table to support us. Achieving the Dream was one of those partners, Jobs for the Future, the Community College Research Center, National Center for Inquiry, all of those kind of folks who were foundational in some of the early research on guided pathways, we brought in to kind of semi-annual events and called everyone together to begin kind of planting the seeds, watering the soil to understand what guided pathways was and how all of these fit together. I'm sure we'll get into it later in the conversation, but holistic case management advising is just one policy of a suite of policies that were approved by our Board of Regents. And together, they are really going to come together over the next several years to really make an impact.
And I'm just maybe before we kind of delve into, say, the support architecture, I'm just wondering, I think some of our listeners, and certainly me being on the other side of the Atlantic, just in terms of the 12 colleges, what was it opt-in or was that, or what was the process in terms of, you know, like getting people involved, Mike?
Yeah, certainly. So, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't mention in 2017, our Board of Regents adopted a plan to bring 12 separately independently accredited community colleges together under a single accreditation called Students First. Simultaneously, they in that same action said that we will implement guided pathways at scale across each of the colleges. So that was going on and still is going on. The merger is a few years out still, to 2023 to be exact. Some of this work is leading out ahead of it. But to your question, it was voluntary. We asked folks from different colleges to make recommendations. We talked with presidents and CEOs. We asked folks who led councils, the folks who chair the Advising Leads Council, the folks who chaired other statewide councils. So we asked for representation and looked kind of to make sure that we had diverse voices at the table. But the 40 members were voluntary. We got together monthly. And in addition to our monthly meetings, we held a several full day kind of planning and design institutes. Where often we'd bring in a national partner or we would facilitate those design institutes. For example, mapping kind of the student process. We looked at kind of how does a student come into the institution and move through the enrollment pipeline to completion, thinking about how the different nuances are at each of the campuses and understanding where those best practices are. So we were looking for them on the campus. We were listening to kind of the national partners who introduced us to folks who were a couple steps ahead of us with this work. We were fortunate enough to attend conferences, both in listen and present, and really start to develop some relationships with folks at some of the other community colleges who've been recognized with, you know, national awards for their advising models. So really that was it was a group of volunteers. They stepped up and did this above and beyond their duty. So we are grateful to that 40-member team. That 40-member team, we realized when we started getting to kind of, it's time to write a policy, that 40 authors might be a bit challenging. I think at that point, Gail and I looked at each other and said, let's try to get it down to 6 or 8. Let's get a good cross-section and ask for some folks to step up and work with us on the actual drafting of the policy. But we didn't want to exclude the 40 members from input. So we actually intentionally first developed a set of guiding principles as a 40-member group, and all kind of came to consensus and agreement on what those guiding principles were. And those became foundational to the pillars of the policy that really anchor and ensure that we're going to get the resources and support and technology that we need to achieve the goals of the model.
Yeah. And so I guess with this, it's like you have a lot of communication, you know, got to get buy-in with this. Was there any pushback in terms of this whole process with this implementation?
I mean, change, as we know, is always difficult. And I think in higher education, sometimes change comes slower to us than perhaps other professions. But I think fundamentally, everyone knew that we needed to do something different. It's just a matter of getting from point A to point B. So I think when we put together our guiding principles, I mean, for example, there are principles you really can't argue with. Like, for example, degree and certificate seeking students should be assigned to an advisor at the college. We wanted to reduce the ratio of student to professional advisors because at its peak, it was around 750-1. And our goal was to reduce that to 250-1. We want all of our students to develop a personalized academic and career plan with goals and strategies, and also to introduce a technology platform to help students achieve success. So these are all things that people can fundamentally agree on. I mean, these are things that are the right thing to do for students. And there are always questions, you know, regarding, how are you going to do this? I mean, we get that you want to do it, but how are you actually going to accomplish that? So I think Mike and I made a very conscious effort, as well as our team, to make sure that we actually continue to visit the colleges and make sure we were keeping the communication lines open. So when the policy was introduced, there was an electronic feedback form where people can provide feedback regarding their thoughts on the policies, areas they thought we can take a closer look at or they didn't like. We also did like what we call a roadshow. Mike and I hit the road to, you know, any colleges that would have us. We would go and present the policy and have an open campus forum, because a lot of times I think what we found is people question change when they don't really understand the policy. So it was really our responsibility to clearly articulate the policy, the purpose of it, the benefits to students, and how this will actually benefit you as an advisor to have a reduced caseload as well. So it was really our responsibility to clearly communicate this information to really kind of ease the anxiety level that comes about with change.
I'll tag on to that too and say that I think, you know, there was maybe more doubt than resistance. And still today, there are kind of folks who might doubt how we're going to pull this off, right? To go from 750-1 to 250-1 was about quadrupling our workforce in advising. Where are the resources going to come from? And still to this day, that is kind of the anxiety and a little bit of a fear that will this actually come to fruition? You'll hear about our implementation in the subsequent podcast, but it is moving along. And part of it was that we intentionally were specific in the policy development to put that as bullet one, that we will reduce caseloads from 750 to 250-1. And the board 100% unanimously endorsed that. And they make decisions about how finances are allocated throughout the colleges. So that wasn't intentionally specific. And we believe, you know, really got us to a place where folks started to believe and they're starting to see this implementation. And now it is coming to fruition.
And so you have the guiding principles, and you're beginning like the formulation of a roadmap, I suppose. It sounds like. Can you talk to us, I suppose, and to listeners, what came next after that step?
I would step back maybe just slightly before the guiding principles too, and say that in addition to our regular meetings and our planning work with the team, we also went out and conducted student focus groups. We held, I think, 4 student focus groups across the campuses and heard from students about their experience. And we also looked at data. We took a look at our SESI and SENSE data on new students and continuing students and engagement in the community colleges, and advising, having an advising connection was important, but not many students had it. And part of that too was understanding that this model, the Guided Pathways Advising model, does not replace faculty advising. The faculty advising will only be enhanced through this model, and that faculty can then be more focused on talking about their discipline, more focused about talking about differentiation in career based on the type of degree that the student is pursuing, where they have that expertise, and that these advisors can then kind of lift some of the administrative burden off of the faculty advisor, where there's a hold on the student's account or something's going wrong with financial aid, or there's an issue outside of school altogether that is interfering with the student's performance. So we really, you know, still to this day are working to make sure we're communicating and being clear about kind of the roles, and that it is additive. It is not replacing faculty advising. So we believe that eventually we'll bring more support to the students from both faculty and staff. So I don't know that I answered your question exactly. You said, so what was next after the roadmap? We traveled to a Holistic Student Support Institute and kind of hibernated for a while and hunkered down and began kind of putting words on paper and really spent a good month or two with the writing process. And it was intense, and it was consuming, and it was Gail and I, and we would be remiss if we didn't mention Ben Wong, who was our policy fellow. He's now at the ACLU in Richmond, Virginia, doing policy work down there. But Ben, Gail, and I together kind of tri-authored the policy. Our policy development team helped us create the outline. They said, we took the guiding principles, the 8 of us got it to an outline form, and then the 3 of us put words to page. It went through many channels. We were lucky to have support from the Student Success Center, the executive director there, and several other colleagues who had worked with. So our managers of Guided Pathways outside of our area were also supports for us. They looked at the document, they reviewed the outline, they read drafts of the policy. So there was a lot of collaboration. And as Gail mentioned, when we got it to a place where we wanted broader feedback, we then opened it up to larger audiences.
Right. And I would say we were very lucky, because, you know, and I would say to other colleges or institutions thinking about radically changing their advising, I'm very grateful to the fact we were able to do this on a full-time basis, because to really put the time and effort that this deserved, it needed to be full-time. You can't split your energies between this and whatever your full-time job is on the side. Like, it would never work. So we were very, very fortunate the fact that we were given the time to really develop this thoroughly and completely and thoughtfully in order to really implement it well. So we were very, very fortunate to have that full-time experience in order to actually accomplish this project.
Yeah, and it's nice that you're saying that you have the time, you're able to develop the resources to it, because I can think of many times or other institutions where it's here, implement this now. I don't know how you're going to do it, but just figure it out. Will there be resources? Let us know what you need. Well, I don't know what I need until I can actually research it. A lot of times there's not even that part. So it is nice to hear that it is something that was really thoroughly thought through.
Yes. And a lot of times we just by virtue of how we function, we are more reactive than proactive. So to your point, like, here's a policy, go and figure it out later. Whereas we were actually saying, okay, we want to develop a policy. Here's the time you need to actually do this correctly. And it was very refreshing, because I think if we had not been given that time and that space away from our full-time roles, I don't think it would have been done as well as the ultimate product of it was.
I think it's important to note too that there was tremendous crossover between the three architectures. So we kind of sat in and shared on each other's work, and even co-led some of the work as well. A college and career success course, CCS 101, was a reimagined first year experience course that Gail and I led with the two faculty leads. So there was a joint kind of subcommittee to work on that. We partnered with institutional research to craft a key performance indicators policy based on some momentum metrics work that was coming out of CCRC and the folks down there. There was the development of meta majors, or areas of study, as we call them in Connecticut, that the choice architecture worked on. The faculty-led group, however, we were significant voices in the room, and that cross-pollination and to be able to work so closely as a team orchestrated by our leader, Greg DeSantis, was really valuable to ensuring that the policies worked with each other and worked together.
And I mean, the 40 became 8, became 3, and then you develop the policies and you're working across. But I suppose in terms of how that looked, in terms of a sort of an organizational structure as such, what way did that work? I don't know whether Mike or Gail, do either of you want to maybe talk in terms of what way it played out? Because, you know, policies are one thing. Procedures and implementation have to follow on from that.
Sure. Well, I mean, I can take kind of the policy part, and I know the implementation is definitely more Mike's role than mine at this point. But, you know, it wasn't just creating a policy and being done. It was definitely a cycle to actually have the policy approved. So once the draft was done and ready to be shared, as we said, we did forums across the state. We had an electronic feedback form as well. We also did presentations to our student advisory council, our statewide council for the community colleges, our advising leads, the academic deans, our deans of students, our community college council of presidents. And we collected feedback from all these different stakeholders before we actually moved through the approval process of the policy, because we wanted to make sure that when the policy moved forward, we had known, we had presented it to as many stakeholders as possible, collected their feedback, and were very thoughtful about it before actually going through the navigation of the approval process. So we did that, and then we went through the various governing bodies at the time. So for us, it was our Guide Pathways Task Force, which is the overarching body for the work we were doing. And then we moved it through things like the Academic and Student Affairs Committee, and finally to the Board of Regents for approval. So the approval process was not quick. It was definitely a several months long process. But again, I think it was done the right way to make sure all the stakeholders were really informed in the loop. And again, really honoring the commitment we made to communicate with them about the policy before it actually moved to the approval piece.
I would add to that, I guess, right in the middle of the approval process comes COVID-19. So we had the policy in what we thought was a finished form around December of 2019, and it's going through the channels December, January, February, March hits, COVID hits. A little stall. However, in April of 2020, the board acted on the policy and did approve the policy in April of 2020. And during that time, through that winter into the spring, there was implementation planning that Gail and I started to lay the groundwork for. How are we going to bring this to scale? Right away, we knew we couldn't do it all at once for many reasons. Bandwidth, too much change, not enough resources.
You know, all the good stuff, yes.
So we envisioned it in kind of three phases, phase 1, 2, and 3, where we split up kind of the size of the schools and distributing them through the regions, and kind of looked at it over a 3-year period. We also started the work of laying out a set of competencies. That was the next critical step for us. So Gail and I spent a good chunk of a few months working really hard on developing advisor competencies. We were fortunate to have some guidance from some of our national partners and got to look around. We didn't need to reinvent the wheel completely, though kind of did. But we developed our guided pathways competencies, which fed into the guided pathways level one and level two job descriptions. So we were intentional, too, about thinking about it in this way. Most of our colleges, in fact, all of them had a director of advising or counseling. Many of those were vacant, but had that position and then had advisors or counselors under them. There was never really an associate director or assistant director, which was interesting. It always struck me as interesting that in admissions and financial aid and everyone else had assistant, associate, and there was one director, and that director advised 90% of the time because the line is there and the students are coming and you need to kind of do it kind of to keep up, to keep pace. So we were pretty intentional about how we were thinking about the structure, both from kind of providing the right size team for supervision, right? And also allowing folks a career ladder. So the Guided Pathways Level 1 advisor has a Guided Pathways Level 2 above it. And at some of the larger schools, that Level 2 will supervise a team of 6 or 8 GPA ones. And above the GPA 2 is the campus advising lead. Above that is 3 regional advising directors. So we also knew that having all 12 of the campus advising leads report to the associate vice president is not a good model to have 12 direct reports. You wouldn't be able to give them kind of the attention and support they needed to make this successful. So we thought through kind of what that organizational structure looked like, began working on those competencies, developing draft job descriptions, working a lot with HR. It started to turn more of, you know, daily meetings, weekly meetings with HR, kind of fleshing out job descriptions, thinking through that process.
Yeah, and I think, you're looking at everything, right? You're looking at the student, you're looking at your advisors, looking at management, the career advancement as well. Does the policy also take into account addressing equity gaps with students?
Yeah, absolutely. So the policy, in addition to the policy, we crafted an equity impact statement that is addendum to the policy that speaks to our intentionality of closing disparities between our Latinx and Black African-American students and our white students. Our equity gap is one of the largest in the country. And we are conscious of that and thinking about the design of the case management model and how some students may need a weekly check-in and others may just need to be seen once a semester, right? So understanding that the model needed to be built kind of in a flexible way so that the students aren't just getting a pair of shoes, they're getting a pair of shoes that fit them, right? So that was really central to our work and thinking about how we can help each student create a plan, know that they have a person to go to, that person is the Guided Pathways Advisor and or the faculty advisor. The Guided Pathways Advisor can monitor their progress on the plan, intervene and support the student. So I often describe it this way. You know, our old advising model was course selection, registration, degree audit. That was kind of the main part of our work. It really flips the paradigm, this model, to that's probably 20% of our new model's work. The other 80% is outreach. It's coaching. It's mentoring. It's check-ins. It's a simple check-in through text or email that, hey, I'm here if you have any questions. How was your first week of classes? Is everything going all right? Let me know if you want to chat. Just very much a change in the paradigm of how advising services have historically been delivered at our colleges.
And again, that is that it's a flip from that reactive model that I think we're all so, it's so ingrained, that's how we do things, to that proactive model. Because, you know, a student who needs help isn't necessarily the one that's going to reach out to you for help. So if we're being proactive about it, we're actually going to, you know, address the issue before it becomes an issue and really help the student succeed.
Yeah, and we'd also be remiss if we didn't mention, you know, some of the work by Karp and Stacy that look at the SIP framework, the strategic, sustained, integrated, proactive, and personalized, right? So that was a foundational kind of concept that was built into our policy and helped us as we drafted the policy and thought through how we were going to bring this model to scale.
And obviously, this, you know, this has been quite the process. Yeah, I mean, we go back to talk about like the, you know, the genesis of it and going all the way through. I'm just wondering for our listeners out there, because I mean, it is fascinating, and I know that there's probably loads, and you know, we only have so much time. But are there takeaways, or are there insights, or are there things that, like, you know, seem obvious now that weren't so obvious, or learnings that you know, you would share with any listeners who are saying, like, God, this is something that I'd love to really look at approaching this. What are the maybe any takeaways that you would offer in that?
I mean, I think for me, one of the key takeaways that, you know, I had to learn as we went through this process is, even if I thought I had clearly communicated something to someone, you need to communicate it more, I think was kind of the takeaway. Because, you know, it's so critical that to do a shift like we have done or in the process of doing, you have to make sure you're communicating each step of the process. So there's no confusion. There's no misinformation being messaged to someone else about a policy or a procedure or a practice. So even if you think you're communicating enough, I would suggest communicating more. But by more, I don't mean wordy, I mean effectively. So, you know, I would say there's succinct and there's verbose. Like, if you can say the same thing in 10 words that you can do in 50, do it in 10, because people will stop reading after word 12. So keep it succinct, clear, and to the point, but make sure you're clearly communicating so that every step of the way people know where you are in the process.
I would add to that too, maybe, you know, take your time, the planning, and allowing that process to take a little longer, I believe will have a much more successful implementation. Oftentimes, Matt, as you mentioned, there's a rush to do something. It worked there, let's do it here. Well, take the time, put a cross-functional team together, free up some of their time. It's worth it to step away for a bit and ensure that there is a cross-functional team and that they're learning from their own practices and learning the national best practices, and take that time. That rush to action, I think, comes back to bite us, because you end up dumping resources into something, and if it fails, those are lost resources. So in my mind, it is cross-functionality. It's having senior leadership, mid-level managers, frontline staff, and faculty at the table. It's giving them that time and space to talk, discuss, think, and plan.
Yeah, it's just like you're saying, you know, have that time, plan it out. It's okay. You don't have to rush through everything. And also kind of to Gail's point with the wording, I mean, in journalism speak, it's don't bury the lead. So definitely a great advice with that. And as we kind of wind down with this portion of the episode, what does the implementation timeframe look like? Is it like a phase implementation? How's it all looking?
That's a great question. So that, you know, has shifted and changed. I think that's another lesson that I should have mentioned in the question before, is flexibility. We are used to having things be one way and kind of stays that way. We've had to be very flexible, and we've had to adjust on the fly and throw a lot of drafts in the trash and start over throughout the process. And same thing can be said about the implementation. We had laid out a 3-year implementation that was in each year, you know, four campuses, 3 campuses, and then 5, I think, was our original plan to do it in stages over 3 years. The early part of that got cut into with COVID. And then came along some Higher Ed Relief Act dollars that were able to be leveraged to support this. So over the last couple months, probably back spring of 2021, I was approached by our leadership at the college and said, how fast could you bring this to scale? And I said, wait, how fast? And they said, yes, how fast? They said, 18 months would be a stretch, but I think we could try to pull it off. So now we've adjusted our kind of 3-year phase-in approach. We have brought 3 colleges to scale with their advisors, and we did that in about 6 months. Then our next group of schools is 5 in phase 2, but phase 2 will happen this fall. And then the final 4 will happen in the spring of 2022. So the goal now is by June of 2022, all 12 campuses are scaled with their advisors, and that we're assigning caseload to each of those advisors. A piece kind of that we haven't touched on is really, and Gail mentioned it about her first day at Middlesex, where you kind of just handed the catalog. And I reflect back often on my experience learning to advise, and it really was being given a catalog and being able to sit next to someone who had been doing it a while and ask a lot of questions. So right away, you know, we knew if we're going to bring on this many new advisors that we were going to need to think carefully and plan a professional learning and training program. So that has been central kind of to the first phase implementation and will be throughout the life of the program. And this isn't just for the newly hired folks. This is ongoing professional learning that we will sustain throughout the time that we deliver the Guided Pathways Advising Model. There was a conscious effort to identify a director of training and professional learning. That position was just recently hired, and we're eagerly awaiting that member to join our team. You'll hear in the next episode the version 1.0 that we created of the asynchronous modules, but that really is going to be kind of only taken to the next level. And we're really placing a focus on professional learning and training for the staff. So by June next year, if we're talking again next fall, I'm hopeful to report back to you and confident that we'll be at scale at all 12 of the colleges with a 250-to-1 ratio for staff to student.
Mike, I think you're going to stick around for the next interview, but conscious that we will be moving into a new phase. But there, for listeners, you know, I think there will be lots of takeaways from this, but there will be loads of, I imagine there might be some people who are like, I don't want more info, or they might be at a stage where, you know, they're thinking it'd be great to pick, you know, your brains and draw on some of your experiences. Are there ways that listeners can get in touch with you to gain some of that insight if they wish to do so?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be more than happy to talk with folks who are interested. They could reach me by sending me an email at my first initial and last name. So MBUCCILLI. At comnet, comnet.edu. I would also point folks to the section through our system office. Guided Pathways has its own section to really take a closer look at the policy. There's a suite of policies that have been approved, as well as this holistic case management advising policy.
Yeah, I think we're happy to talk to anyone, because, you know, it's one of those things, like, you're never going to know what it's like unless you've experienced it yourself in the whole process. So I think having lived this for now, I think this January, it'll be 4 years since we started this work. I think I'm certainly happy to talk to someone about the beginning stages of the process and the planning process. And then I will leave it to Mike and his team for the implementation piece.
Yeah, I mean, I'll add there too. You mentioned we went from 40 to 8. Down to 3. And, you know, last summer, Gail and I both applied for and were hired as associate vice presidents. And then we were separated. We often joke that, you know, we call it HCMA, Holistic Case Management Advising, was our baby.
Yes.
Right. We delivered this baby when it was approved by the board. And then I was there with the infant as a single dad until I was able to bring on the three regional advising directors who quickly became outstanding parents to our policy as it's grown into implementation of the Guided Pathways Advising Program. So in our next episode, you'll get to meet two of the three regional advising directors. One of them, Kathleen Ahern, actually had an actual baby and is out on maternity leave right now. But you will get to meet the other parents of the implementation work.
Well, just all that remains for the end of this particular section is to thank both of you. Gail and Mike, it's been really fascinating to gain insights into the work that you have undertaken and to hear all about your expertise and experiences. So thanks for taking the time to join myself and Matt today.
No, thank you. This was fun. We're happy to be here.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks to Gail and Michael for sharing insights into the establishment of a guided pathways model, from planning and identification to support architecture to policies and procedures. It was fascinating to hear about the processes and all the steps involved along the way.
Before we get to part two of our episode, let's check with Dane Zanowski from Temple University to find out what's the latest on Dane's desk on our Adventures in Advising YouTube channel.
Hello, Adventures in Advising podcast listeners. This is Dane Zanowski coming to you from Dane's Desk, the new YouTube video series as a spinoff of the Adventures in Advising podcast. I want to talk about some great videos that we have for you. This past week, our guest was Banks Blair. He is the incoming chair of the Advisor Training and Development Advising Community, and he talks about a very important topic of advisor self-care. And then the video coming up next week will be with Jake Rudy, who also talks about advisor self-care. Again, this is a very important topic and something I can, you know, encourage our listeners and viewers to really think about how you're taking care of yourself so you can take care of the students that you advise. If you want to connect with me, feel free to do so through Facebook or LinkedIn. If you have ideas about future topics for Dane's Desk, or if you want to be a guest on Dane's Desk, feel free to connect with me. And as always, keep advising.
All right, thanks, Dane. And check out the current episode as well as past episodes of Dane's Desk on our YouTube channel at Adventures in Advising. These are short style interviews with those in academic advising where you get quick sound advice and tidbits to add to your advising toolbox. Now we're back with the second part of our interview. Previously, we were chatting about the history of what Connecticut State is doing with their community colleges and implementation of guided pathways. And for this one, we welcome back Michael Buccilli. Welcome, Michael. And also we have Dr. Brian Capinos, who's also a returning guest to our podcast. When we last spoke with Brian, he was the Assistant Academic Dean at the College of Our Lady of the Elms. Now, Brian is the Regional Advising Director of the Northwest Region for Connecticut State Community College. Brian holds a doctoral degree in educational leadership from the University of Hartford. Brian's research and publications are focused on advising systems, middle management, and the coordination of advising services within post-secondary institutions. Brian, welcome back to the podcast.
Great to be here, everyone.
Yeah, and next up, we have Dr. Lisella Arboleda, is the Regional Advising Director for the Connecticut State Community College's Capital East Region. In this role, Lisella is responsible for the implementation of the CSCU Holistic Case Management Advising Policy and the scaling, oversight, and operation of the Guided Pathways Advising Program at Capital, Manchester, Middlesex, Three Rivers, and Quinebaug Community Colleges. Prior to this role, Lisella was the acting director of counseling and wellness at Gateway Community College. In addition, she was the director of GCC's Family Economic Security Program and served as the campus retention specialist from 2015 to 2017. Lisella holds a doctoral degree in leadership and innovation from New York University, a master of science degree in clinical mental health counseling, and a bachelor of arts degree in liberal studies with concentrations in history and psychology from Southern Connecticut State University and is a proud Gateway Community College alum. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And lastly, we have Michael Gomans, who currently serves as the Director of Student Success Technology for the Connecticut State Community College, which includes overseeing the implementation, oversight, and all functional aspects for the technology platforms within student success management. Prior to joining Connecticut State, Michael spent 8 years at the University of Hartford in various roles, including time with admissions, the College of Education, Nursing, and Health Professions, and the Division of Student Success. His most recent role was of the assistant director and first-year advisor for the Center of Student Success, advising an average caseload of 100 first-year students and serving as the functional lead for the student success platform utilized by the institution. Michael also serves as an adjunct faculty member, teaching undergraduate and graduate courses in education, human development, and technology. Welcome to the podcast as well.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
We are delighted to welcome our three new guests and welcome Michael back. I think the first part of this was really fascinating. I have no doubt this will be as well. One of the things that we do like to do is to give our listeners the opportunity to get to know you a little bit before we delve into the topic. Lisa, I might start with you. Just in terms of a potted history in your work in higher education, could you talk us through, I suppose, how you found yourself where you are now?
Yes, absolutely. As Matt mentioned, I am a proud Connecticut State Community College alum. And while I was finishing my bachelor's degree under the leadership of Michael Buccilli, actually, I was hired as a part of the new student advising and registration, which is really where my start with advising began and really my passion for advising. From that role, I, under Michael's leadership as well, I became the student retention specialist, where I really focused on marginalized populations, overseeing the Male Minority Initiative and some achievement coaching models that we put together at Gateway. During that time, I was finishing my master's in clinical mental health counseling. At the time, counseling and advising went hand in hand. So while my primary role was mental health counseling, I was still very much advising. And it was through those different roles that I realized the impact that academic advising has on students and how crucial it really is to our student population. And more specifically, as we make our way to the holistic case management advising model, but really being in that space and identifying that this HCMA policy that we now have, that there was such a need for it. So in that role, I really prided myself on being a voice for the students and really communicating the need for such a model to leaders such as Michael, for him to do what he did at the system level in implementing the policy. So that's sort of my trajectory. And now here I am as the regional advising director, overseeing the implementation of the policy for 5 of the 12 Connecticut State Community Colleges, and really enjoying the work and really seeing how all the work that all of us have done all of this year sort of come to fruition. And yeah, it's exciting. It's exciting stuff. Thank you.
Absolutely. And Michael Buccilli, we heard from you in the last episode, so I might go to the other Michael. can you talk us through, I suppose, how you found yourself in your current role?
Yeah, certainly. So I, like Matt mentioned earlier, I spent most of my time in higher ed at the University of Hartford. I'm an alum from Hartford. I have a bachelor's degree in health sciences and physical therapy. And after graduating, I was fortunate enough to work in the undergraduate admissions office and spent some time recruiting students to come to Hartford and really got a taste for what working in higher ed was like, and was immediately attracted to staying in higher ed. So I did. I finished my master's in education and actually started teaching elementary school here in Connecticut, and really quickly realized why I loved working with those students. I really missed working in higher education. So the first opportunity that was presented to me was actually to come back to Hartford. So I took it. I was the Collegiate Director of Student Success for the College of Education, Nursing, and Health Professions. Big, long title for a lot of miscellaneous jobs. I was responsible for academic advising, course evaluations and registration, making sure students graduated on time, recruitment events for the college. And just about 3 years ago, the university made a shift to a first-year advising model. They put a lot of resources into what is now their division of student success, and they created a combined services office that I was fortunate enough to join as an assistant director. They were aware of my work with the technology and advising on campus, so I was given the opportunity to lead the implementation of their holistic case management software that they were using for advising. And then I saw this opportunity with Connecticut State. And at that time, I thought, I want to be doing more. I want to work with a wider population. And this was a perfect opportunity, combined all the things I really liked about my career, working with technology, working with students, and working with this population in particular. So I was fortunate enough to meet Michael and LaCella and Brian, and they were happy enough to offer me an opportunity on the team, and I'm glad I took it. And I've been here since April, overseeing the technology that we're working on. Really excited about it. I'm having a really good time.
Great. We're looking forward to chatting to you further about that. And Brian, I know you're a returning guest, but it's been a little while, and you're wearing a different hat. So it might be worthwhile just giving listeners the opportunity, a potted history of your higher ed background.
So the last time that we spoke, we were talking a lot about advising systems and middle management and some of the research and that I had done with my dissertation, and kind of what better way to fall into all of that work than to fall into working for the state of Connecticut and working with Mike Buccilli and his team, working on this holistic case management policy and really the development and redesigning the entire 12 community colleges. So, when I saw the opportunity online for this position, although I had greatly appreciated my time as the assistant academic dean at Elms College, I couldn't not try for this position. And so I gave it a shot, and I was lucky enough to join the team in January, and I've been here ever since, and it's been fascinating work. It's absolutely exciting to be a part of this kind of this movement to best practices in advising with the state of Connecticut to redesign an entire advising system statewide. And I really think that this work is going to set the groundwork for future states and other colleges to look at our work and look at some of the challenges and great successes that we're going to have, and really be able to kind of shift into a way that really supports their students better. And so for me, I'm just excited to be here. I'm still, teaching at the University of Hartford. I'm still writing. I have hopefully some publications coming down the line in the future. And I just had one exciting one published with Nakata in June. So I'm just happy to be here, happy to be a part of this, and happy to kind of take my knowledge and expertise and really help the students of the Connecticut Community College System.
Welcome, everyone. And we really appreciate all of you being here to continue this conversation. Now, we heard from Michael and Gail earlier about how this idea started, the buy-in, the communication and teamwork that's involved, how the policy developed, the goals, the add-on to help address equity gaps, and also the advisor competencies and guided pathways. And I know we'll definitely get to the technology aspect in a moment, but maybe we start with talking more about the kind of the conceptualization of the guided pathways. So who wants to take that?
I'd be happy to start. I think I'd like to give the listeners a sense into what it was like when you first discussed this. I remember sitting in our meetings in January and listening to Mike and all of his wonderful big ideas and being like, how are we going to do this? Like, how are we actually going to, like, together as this small team on Microsoft Teams in middle of January, like, develop an entire curriculum, like, designed for professional learning and growth for all of the employees in the community college system in Connecticut. And for me, it was a wonderful challenge, but it was overwhelming. I mean, where do you start? We had some ideas and things that Mike, provided us with his leadership and guidance, but really it was LaCella and I and our other regional advising director, Kat Ahern, who we're kind of just sitting in meetings together talking about, like, where do we begin? What scholarship do we pull? Where do we look for content? How could we have an opportunity to just start fresh with training across the board? And what do advisors need to know about supporting students? I mean, it was honestly overwhelming at first. But I think that as we got into the work and we continued to move along, and I'll pass it over to LaCella for her thoughts, I think it really started to unfold where we started to focus on really our student populations and what our advisors need to know about working with a diverse range of students in the state of Connecticut. It evolved into discussing our mission and vision for revamping advising and getting our advisors that information as well, and thinking about thinking about advising practice as a whole and leaning on resources, you know, like Nakata and a lot of the information they have as far as how do we work with our students, how do we talk with our students, how do we coach our students. And overall, I think that we've put forth for version 1.0, I think a fabulous program that we're continuing to build on with the assistance of Michael Gomans and our new director of technology, and our professional learning and professional development. I think I butchered that title, but I'm excited about it. I think there's a lot of awesome components to it. And LaCella was with us the whole time on it. So LaCella.
Yeah, very, very well said. One thing I would like to add, one thing we leveraged really well was we identified amongst the regional advising directors and of course, Michael Buccilli, identifying what our strengths were and how we were going to take our individual strengths and what lift we ourselves could take, right? Advising theory, I wasn't in the weeds the way that Brian was. We relied really heavily on him before we had Michael Gomans for technology. That was Kat Ahern's sort of jam, as I say. And she took, you know, that on. And I'm really passionate and in the weeds with diversity, equity, inclusion, and how that translates to marginalized populations and what, you know, new research was saying. So that was one of the things that we did pretty early on, which, and I agree with Brian, it was really overwhelming. How do you do this? How do you conceptualize this, but that really helped. And then I would add that the other thing we did was really lean on our network. So that was our network within Connecticut State, who was doing what, who was doing it well, who was willing to consult with us, relied heavily on Nakata, and other professional organizations to sort of help put our, we had our mission and vision, but to really help visualize that and identify sort of what steps we needed to take to make it more real. So those are the sort of micro level things that I think we were able to do that really helped us. And it really helped with, you know, leadership matters and the relationship we have with each other and sort of identifying that early on, we were all in this together, really helped us sort of come together as a team, you know, none of us with our egos set aside and say, what can I sort of take the lead on? Where can I lean on you? Where can we lean on others? And that translated really well for version 1.0.
I might add a comment in too, though slightly different in kind of the phase we were in, you know, that these are the same things Gail and I grappled with in the early days of kind of getting the group together and getting to a policy, kind of in the room looking at each other. So that kind of productive struggle of figuring out what each other's strengths were, I saw it happening with Kat, Brian, and LaCella. And it was intentional to put the three of them together because they all bring such tremendous strengths and difference and diversity. And together, those struggles produced what I believe is a phenomenal product for our first version of the professional learning program and the onboarding and the 30-60-90 plans. Like a whole lot of great ideas came out of giving them that time and space. And you know, I was there and I joined them on many meetings, but they had that productive struggle, kind of that silence and kind of figuring out where to go and what do we do first. And I had been through it. So I was there kind of as a voice of it's going to be OK. You guys all have what it takes to pull this off.
And I suppose I like that, you know, that piece around the conceptualization and the team coming together and figuring it out and what the strengths are and where you're going to go and drawing on the resources that you needed. I mean, that's all part of it. But can you take us to the next level then? I mean, you had the struggle, but then you got to get into the nuts and bolts. You got to look at the program development and the curriculum. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think that really what came down to it is that once we had our curriculum developed, we need to look at a platform to do this. And I think Michael Gomans would probably be best to discuss a little bit more about this. But it's once you like hash out, you know, what you're going to do on a giant Word document of the curriculum and the focus on mission and vision and advising theory and diversity, equity and inclusion and student populations and ethics and advising, you have to actually put this somewhere. Like so that people can access it in some sort of way and deliver this training. And I think that our partnership with our technology platform and really kind of navigating that whole perspective is something that Michael has had the lead on and really knows it like the back of his hand. So I'd actually turn it over to Mike to walk us through kind of those challenges and how do we actually take this this great idea that we finally put on paper and actually execute it?
Yeah. So we partnered with a company out of Colorado called Innovative Educators, who specialize in online services for orientation, support and training for faculty and staff. And I came in April at what I now consider the perfect time. It was right in the middle of the eye of the storm when Michael and Lisella and Brian and Kat were in the middle of developing all this curriculum. And it was so evident and clear that each of them had such a strong passion for figuring this problem out and presenting it in a way that was most realistic and adaptable for all the faculty and staff that we're going to have this presented to in the coming months. So I was excited to get on board with Innovative Educators. That platform allowed us the most amount of adaptability in terms of how we would deliver courses. It was important to us that we used multiple modalities to deliver the trainings that we had come up with. So whether they were articles, publications, case scenarios, PowerPoints, and a variety of videos from different resources that we wanted staff to review and train and be assessed on. This platform gave us the option to do that. So like Brian and Lisella both mentioned, I was happy to take the lead on crafting all of that. Really what I was doing was taking all the good work that they had done and laying it out like a big map and putting it in an order that made the most sense for our staff moving forward. We have at the moment for version 1.0, 25 modules, which I think were all crafted really purposefully and clear. We have, I would say, just about 90% of our staff at the moment done with version 1.0, which is fantastic. The platform itself gives us the opportunity to look at reports every week, see how staff are interacting with those modules. We've built in both pre- and post-assessments to measure their learning, and we've even built in survey options to really make sure that everyone that's being tasked with looking at these modules has a fair opportunity to give feedback and to let us know what's working, what's not, what would they like to see changed, what's different. That's probably the broadest overview I can give you about the technology and where we are at the moment.
I would like to add something, if I may, to piggyback off of what Brian shared when we talk about sort of conceptualizing in our curriculum. And he gave you an example of some of our modules, if you will, right? Our advising fundamentals and equity-centered practice. And I think it's important for listeners, right? We're talking about community colleges. So when we are putting this together and we are referring back to what the literature and what research shows, a lot of it is geared towards four-year institutions. So we had to take that, really deconstruct it. What is going to work and what is going to translate well to the community colleges? And then look at our community college or each of our institutions and their data, what has worked, what isn't working, and really marry the two. And that is really, really important to note, because it's not like you go out there and you get these frameworks and you just build off of that framework. You take an existing framework, you look at it, it's not necessarily designed for community colleges. So how do we take that and how do we redesign that and make it work for our student population? And we look through that lens for each of the modules that we went through. And it led to some really robust discussions, right? I'm a scholar. I like to lean pretty heavily on existing research, but also holding myself accountable to saying if this is not working and it hasn't worked, what is within our control to work? And where is that space to, as like Michael Buccelli likes to say, like to make some mistakes and to break things, if you will, so that we can get it right for our student population.
And I guess going off of that, is there anything like when you were looking at the research and the literature that was more geared for 4 year that when you did deconstruct it, you said we can actually connect this to the 2 year community colleges and what we're trying to do?
Yeah, and I would shoot this back to Brian, but for me, sort of my aha moment is advising theory, right? And the relationship of advising to student success was really sort of fundamental, and that hasn't shifted for me. So that really, yes, it works for the 4 year, but that was really important to have that foundation for the 2 year, the community colleges. I would say where we sort of shifted is where we get more specific to populations, but that's where we have our modules for specific student populations. But I would say overall advising theory, the relationship between advising and student outcomes, that remained the same and sort of untouched for me personally.
Yeah, I think as well. I mean, you know, unfortunately, and this is a scene across the United States, a lot of community colleges and especially advising offices are underfunded. There's not a lot of staff. And so it very much is a lot of transactional actions at the community college level. And we're trying to change that with our practice and the holistic case management policy. So you're thinking about teaching advising theory to community college advising staff and talking about that very holistic centered advising, kind of almost like pumping the brakes on what is always a very fast paced environment for them, it was something that I really wanted to think about, and how I trained and spoke with all of the staff about advising theory and applying these different tools within their toolboxes. And it's not because the staff either didn't want to do this practice. Some of them were already doing this practice, but the thing is that, again, historically, community college advising offices are always underfunded. There's so many students and there's only so many staff. And even with your heart in the right place about wanting to do this very holistic approach and sit down with a student for a half hour, 45 minutes, an hour, and talk with them about how they're doing, that just doesn't happen in a school with 3,500 staff members and 3,500 students and 3 staff members in the advising office. Like, it's just you against the world at that point. And so it was very intentional when we were talking about advising theory, which I think at 4-year institutions, a lot of times, especially those that are better off financially, can have a lot of advising staff and take those times to talk about the advising theory and how that works. And for the community colleges that sometimes are so financially strapped, that's a tough thing to do. And so we're in an amazing place right now in the state of Connecticut to be able to have those conversations with our advisors and to emphasize that holistic approach with students. And to almost what I've been telling my staff is, this is the time where you actually can pump the brakes. I want to write slow down on the wall. Like, we need to slow down and be with our students. And the investment in advising and the amount of money that's been invested by the state of Connecticut to do this is really that opportunity for us to slow down with our students and really kind of listen to them and where they're at. So
I might add a bit there too, to add on to what Brian and Lucilla both shared, in that, you know, oftentimes you look at like the body of literature on coaching, and it kind of is a blurred line between coaching and advising. And we're trying to bring kind of those two together in some ways. And thinking about, I mentioned in the prior episode, really a small portion of our advisors in the Guided Pathways model will be doing that registration and schedule creation and degree audits. And their primary job will be really doing that coaching and mentoring. So I think we have to look at different bodies of literature, you know, that coaching, mentoring, and advising, and kind of finding the synergies between them as they develop the professional learning program and we continue to implement.
And I suppose, and Michael, we spoke to you and Gail about this in that first interview in terms of buy-in, but this was a different stage of things, and concepts are lovely and the theory is lovely and everyone agrees on a one-to-one level, you know, that we can discuss it and we can agree. But how do you go about like getting buy-in for this at scale at this stage of the program?
I can kick that off and just say, you know, we've continued the same way we were very inclusive with the policy development work. We've had monthly forums throughout the spring where we opened it up to Q&A for 90% of the time. We had a short kind of update and then we took questions. We have an online feedback forum where we can receive feedback anonymously from any staff or faculty across the campuses. So keeping that communication open. The second part I would say is relying on the experts we already had working on those campuses. So the incumbent existing staff members there have been tapped and leveraged to do a lot of kind of the supporting the new hires. So I think both Kat, Lucilla, and Brian have been very intentional about seeing that they have this expertise in folks on the campus and lifting that up. And we intend to bring that to the next level where those folks can start joining us in some of the kind of creation of a version 2.0, all right, and contribute to that and host events where there's a sharing of concepts and ideas from the phase one schools with the phase two and three campuses. So really that inclusivity, communication, and getting on the ground too. You know, Lucilla, Brian, and Kat are there. They rotate through and visit the campuses and work closely with the lead on each campus.
I'd be happy to chime in on a campus specific level, and I'll talk about Middlesex Community College in the Capital East region. As far as buy-in was, that's where the sort of mission and vision of what we are doing with Guided Pathway really comes into play, and helping folks on campus really see it, because in order to bring them along, they need to be able to see it. They need to be able to conceptualize it. So including them in this process, for me at Middlesex, that was really important with faculty. Faculty was really hands-on with advising. They feared that Guided Pathway Advising would come in and sort of take their student advisees, and they were really worried about that. And it took the campus advising lead and myself at the table to say, look, this is our mission and vision. We are an extension of you. You are in the classroom. You want to deliver your curriculum. Your primary job, right, is to teach our students. We are an extension of that. So how do you envision Guided Pathway Advisors sort of complementing your role? And then, as Michael mentioned, sort of that wealth of knowledge that they hold. So now they play a primary role in really mentoring our Guided Pathway Advisors to have these areas of expertise. Michael may have talked about in the last podcast areas of studies. So we have areas of study set up at Middlesex, and we have faculty advisors attached to the Guided Pathways, and we're always anchoring it with that mission and vision. And now they can see it. And that being able to see it really helps with the buy-in. And now they're our biggest advocates. Now when their colleagues across the system are saying, oh, well, Guided Pathways this, they're the first ones on the line to say, well, that's not really true, or this is what's happening at Middlesex, and this is how it's helping us. So that has been really helpful to me over at Middlesex. So I just wanted to share that on campus level.
I also just wanted to bring one thing else. It was very intentional with, especially when we were beginning these conversations, and Mike Buccilli had tasked us with working on and developing campus implementation teams on each of the phase one schools. And really, a campus implementation team is a group of professionals within student affairs and academic affairs coming together to talk about this work with Guided Pathways Advising. And we were very intentional in diversifying those committees to be able to bring faculty to the table, professionals in admissions and registrars and financial aid and student activities and wellness, and bringing everybody to the table to talk about the implementation of this work. And I think that helped with buy-in across all of our phase one schools. I know for myself as well, you know, I got to meet some of the very key players and faculty in the big programs at my phase one schools to have conversations with them about how our work will help them and their students. And then how can we also hear what they need and support their work as well, you know, as faculty members who are working within this advising space as well. And so these campus implementation teams that were designed to bring academic affairs and student affairs professionals together to have these conversations, I think really started some of the teamwork building that happened and really kind of shaped some of the good work that's been started surrounding our Guided Pathways implementation.
Yeah, and to do all of this, like, you need staff for this. So how, with the Guided Pathways Advising, like, how does the hiring go with leadership, or as well as getting advising staff for all of this?
It almost feels like it never ends when you are scaling up some of these advising offices to be at scale for how many advisors we need. I can't tell you how much time LaSalle and I have spent together interviewing people, across the state. But this work really requires, it's a big time investment from our GPA, our Guided Pathways Advising leadership team, to spend the time to be intentional about hiring and really finding the right people for this work. And I certainly can turn it over to both Mike and Mike Buccilli and LaSalle to talk about the commitment to diversity with our hiring. But we have been very, very strategic in the way that we've structured our job descriptions to be inclusive to a lot of areas that really do excellent work with students that we normally wouldn't have within the advising spectrum of our hiring at that point. And so we wanted to be intentional with regards to being very specific about who we wanted to bring into this work, and be also diversify our staff so that they could meet all of our students where they're at. So, but I'll turn it over, like I said, to Mike and LaSalle to talk a little bit more about that. But I feel like I've been interviewing since March.
Yeah, I can add a bit there. I would say it's been, a collaborative effort a big lift by the leadership team for Guided Pathways Advising. However, the campus CEO plays a key role there as well. When we're hiring the leads of the campus, they're participatory in the finalist interviews. When we are putting together a campus interview committee, the CEO or president makes recommendations to be added to the committee. We have done things to try to streamline because this amount of hiring needs some streamlining. So creating a set of questions that are standard across the campuses, but allowing the campus the flexibility to add a question or two that is unique to their specific student population and their campus's needs. But the time invested in hiring matters, and I will defer to Lucella and Brian, who have more hours logged with HR and searches than I do at this point. But it is a big lift.
You may have to cut me off, and I won't be offended if you do. This is definitely something I'm extremely passionate about. I am a Latina in higher education. We are in higher education and leadership. We are very few and far between. So the hiring process for me, personally, it's two parts. I'll say it in two parts. So the first is we're hiring towards a vision, right? We're hiring not to to fit into the mold of the current advising. We're hiring to deliver on our HCMA policy, our guided pathway advising. So that's one. A majority, I would say, of folks in higher education have a higher ed background. The way that we hired for Guided Pathways is we really opened that up to a diverse pool of candidates, diverse backgrounds, race, ethnicity, gender, area of expertise, degrees, things like that. I'll use Middlesex as an example of what I did with Middlesex. Was I really took a look at their student population. Then I looked at the candidate pool that we had, and I was really intentional about hiring at Middlesex, of course, being qualified. Let me just say that since this is going to be circulated, they had to be qualified. The taking those qualified candidates and really being intentional about bringing Guided Pathway advisor leadership and advisors on who really represented their campus student body. That was magical for me, as I said, as a Latina, to be in this position to really put forward the vision for Guided Pathways, but to be in a position where I can actually hire a diverse workforce to do this work is just, it's magical. It is music to my ears. It fills my soul. And we did that. And I think all of our Campus One schools, we did really well about diversifying. And again, not just diversity in race, ethnicity, and gender, but in areas of expertise too. And Guided Pathways, the way that Michael sort of put the Guided Pathways advising model together, really allowed for that. And it's already paying off. For example, areas of studies over at Middlesex, we have an individual who has a bachelor's in criminal justice. His area of study is a criminal justice degree. Faculty love that because now they have someone who went through the curriculum, who has experience in the workforce, who can now support them. We have someone else in human services who is now doing social sciences, who is collaborating with faculty. So diversifying our workforce, it was just a win-win all around. And quite frankly, it was about time. So I was really excited to be a part of that and really proud of the work we did with diversifying our workforce. I'll stop there because I can keep going.
I just want to bring to light really fast, when you think about the case management advising model, you really have to think about the skill set that comes to being involved in that advising model. Working in a holistic advising model, it requires a great deal of attention to the student, understanding their own personal challenges, what they're going through, where they're at, what resources are available to support students. This isn't our traditional advising practice. If we go back to, O'Banion's model of advising in 72 and we look at what advising was, that's not what it is today. Like, advising is much more holistic. It is much more meeting the student where they are at. It is much more navigating personal socioeconomic challenges that students are facing. We are not just discussing the curriculum anymore. We are helping students navigate the scene of higher ed and also helping them navigate their own personal and socioeconomic challenges that they're facing in their lives so that they can be successful in the classroom. And that takes a unique skill set now. Advising has changed, and we're very much very excited to be at the forefront of that when we think about our hiring policies and we're thinking about who we're bringing to the table, who are our next Guided Pathways advisors. It's those people in all different types of lines of work, in the fields of social work and teaching and the nonprofit sectors. It's individuals who have experience helping students, clients navigate these challenges, because this is what advising is now. Advising is no longer this transactional very approach to let me get your classes and you get on out of here. This is a very much kind of a holistic, hands-on, helping students navigate the landscape of higher ed in their own personal lives so that they can be successful and earn an education credential or transfer. And so I think that's played very much into our vision for hiring and what we want out of our GPA staff, because it's important and really it's the right thing to do.
Just to Brian's point, because one of the things that we have heard, we talk about all the pros, but I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about some of the pushback, right? So some of like, oh, well, these advisors don't have a higher ed background, but being cross-sectoral and cross-functional is very important. And we're seeing that now, right? I think when we diversify our workforce the way that we have, and we have sort of cross-sectoral guided pathway advisors sort of in the mix, that really, in my opinion, at least in my experience so far, has really minimized the sort of groupthink. We're not all looking through this work through the same lens. And everyone from their sector have something to contribute to what this holistic case management advising model could look like and what guided pathway advising could potentially be. But if I'm only looking at this work through a higher ed lens, then I'm looking at it through one way. We all go through sort of similar training, similar coursework. But when you have folks from different sectors, you really increase and maximize on all their areas of expertise. And that's how amazing Guided Pathways has been in phase one and will continue to be, because we all are looking at this work, one mission, one vision, but through a different lens. And great ideas come from that. And I think that has been really undervalued, and that's an important point to make in hiring.
I would add one last piece to that, and just that this was intentional. We made an intentional choice to go from what was a master's degree plus 2 years experience to even get in the door to a bachelor's degree and professional experience in a related area. And we allowed for candidates to tell us their story and how they were connected to the mission and vision of Guided Pathways. And that has opened up a diverse and robust kind of workforce candidate pool. And to echo what Lucella and Brian have said, that great ideas are coming out of folks who are just stepping into higher ed as a professional. And that we often kind of see through that same lens, and our students may not be seeing through that lens, especially if they're first gen, especially if they're new in college. So meeting the students where they are is more likely to happen if you bring that diversity of background and perspective.
And I think that intentionality is so important. And I think that plus that commitment to diversity, it's similar what I'm seeing in some institutions in terms of the student intake, that in terms of their they're looking not just at academics, but they're looking to bring in diverse cohorts who have maybe experience in the areas. So I think maybe higher ed is opening up that way, which is good. But maybe just in terms of kind of getting where we are now, because Michael, you'd mentioned, I think, early in our interview, one of the aims, I think, was the reduction for student advisors from 750 to 1 to 250 to 1. And I suppose with the nuts and bolts now in place and the work ongoing, where are we now on that?
I can tell you from my phase one school that my advisors are busy. I look at their calendars and what we would assume is as soon as you get through ad drop in the community colleges in the past, it's been almost like a lull afterwards. It's like, oh, we survived we survived AdDrop, and now we have a couple of, you know, weeks until we can get into the registration kind of phase. That approach has been flipped on its head. And we are now extremely intentional about reaching out to students in this first 1 to 3 weeks is our game plan for as many students as we could possibly see, because we know through the literature that this contact with students immediately and at least starting these conversations will help lead to better levels of persistence, better levels of retention, if they know through the gate that they have somebody to talk to in that first 1 to 3 weeks, 1 to 4 weeks, when some of those initial challenges come up for students where they may decide, well, maybe college isn't right for me. Maybe I made a mistake there. How do we get those students in the door with in between weeks 1 through 4? So my advising staff at Northwestern Connecticut Community College have been working extremely hard. Their calendars are jam-packed. I'm here today at Northwestern. I'm here to talk with them and see how they're doing and to show a face here and a presence for them, because I know that they've been working so hard. And so, but we're, you know, even still though, the 250-to-1 is an admirable reduction. It's still a lot, you know, but it allows the time. It does allow the flexibility and time for us to meet with students and have those conversations. And so that's what I am hearing on the ground from my staff, is that they are having these conversations with students virtually and in person. They are able to talk with them about their goals and where they're at. And so for my phase one school, certainly it's been very, very, very busy, but that's a good thing. I mean, we want to see this foot traffic. This is why we're here. So, and I'll turn it over to LaCella to get her perspective on her phase one school.
You won't be surprised to hear this, Brian, but I'm exactly where you are, because I'm using the framework that you actually put together for Northwestern. So, right, Brian put a lovely framework together. We're weeks 1 to 3, we're really focusing on the outreach to students as a touch point. Then, you know, weeks 3 to 5, we'll transition, start thinking more about retention, start keeping an eye on the data. So I'm exactly where Brian is. So I have nothing to contribute other than that the advisors are very busy. They are meeting with their caseload in the community college system. You know, there's that push for sort of registration. So those students who sort of got pushed through to register, but not necessarily meet with their advisor and have sort of an in-depth discussion, we're doing intentional outreach for them right now. So that's the phase that we are currently in.
I can add to this too. I would say that, you know, by the end of this calendar year, it is our goal to have five additional schools at scale, and then during the spring semester, the final 4 campuses at scale. So by June next year, we will be at scale. But I think it's also important to talk a little bit about our advising technology and our platform that we're developing, because I think, to Brian's point, 250 still is a lot. So one of the key aspects of the policy, the HICMA policy, was to implement a student success technology platform that allows advisors to monitor progress, to triage, and to intervene proactively, so that, you know, not all students may need the same thing. We know they don't, right? So Michael G is really leading the functional work as we move towards implementation with that piece of technology this coming spring as well. Michael, you want to talk a little bit about how you envision that coming out, and there's the training with it, and there's a whole nother lift that is associated with the implementation of that technology.
Yeah, certainly. And for me, with and there's so many exciting things about what we're doing and that we've talked about today, but biasly for me, this is probably one of the most exciting, is the technology piece. And it really breaks down to how are we gathering data and what are we doing with it? So some of the immediate things that we've already started doing as we move through these phases in implementation are collecting intake surveys from students at our phase one institutions, and more holistic intake surveys that focus on their career and academic needs and their holistic needs at home. We know our population varies very widely, and we would be remiss if we implemented this type of model and then didn't take into account what all our varying student needs could potentially be. The system that we're going to be using is an operational and collaborative CRM product from Ellucian that really affords us the opportunity to really bring all the stakeholders on each of the campuses together to make sure that we're providing comprehensive wraparound services for our students as quickly and expeditiously as they need them, which is something that I think, unfortunately, we would all agree we didn't have the resources to do before. We may have had those experts and resources on campus, but there wasn't a clear or comprehensive way to connect those folks, either between offices or students to offices. So we are purposefully building this CRM tool to do just that. Not only with our academic advisors, but we're going to bring in other offices like Veterans Affairs, International Services, Career and Academic Advising all together to make sure that when a student needs to have their plan revised, if their situation changes, we're doing that as a team and not in isolation. So to Brian's earlier point, a caseload of 250 students is still a lot. It's very comprehensive, but a tool like this allows all of our staff and our campus leaders to really get a whole picture of the student, where they are, what supports they need, and it gives us as a leadership team the opportunity to evaluate that data on a very consistent basis, whether it be daily, weekly, monthly, and then make those data-informed decisions that I'm always excited to look at. It gives us an opportunity for process improvement. It gives us an opportunity to see what's working, and we can continue to pour resources into those areas. And it most importantly, gives us an opportunity to see what's not working. Where are we falling behind? Where do students need more resources? I think that's something that we've all wanted to do in the past, but this is really the first biggest opportunity we have to do it in practice. So we plan on implementing in early spring of 2022. And with that, it's going to come a whole series of training. We're going to follow a train-the-trainer model for a lot of leadership on each of the campuses. I'm excited to part with our new director of training and professional learning to roll out what we'll call end-user training for upwards of 200-plus Guided Pathways advising staff. And we should be up and operational with our timeline by March and April, which, again, for me is really exciting. It gives us an opportunity to really see this in action and see our work come to a peak, if you will, after the first year. So a lot of exciting opportunities ahead in the coming months.
Yeah, and we're definitely looking forward to possibly having you on again and seeing where things are at maybe in a year. And it's great to see that there is this holistic approach with the students, with the staff, with the leadership, and you know, best to you on this continued implementation. But we have reached the end of this interview, and there's a lot of information that's been given both in the first part of this interview with the history of it and also now with the implementation. So a lot of tidbits from how it all started, the structure, the organization, the beginnings of the implementation to now. But we heard from the last interview that some of this information is on the website, but if anyone wanted to reach out, any listeners wanted to reach out, had questions or comments, how can they reach out to you?
So I think they can reach out to any one of our emails. We'd be happy to talk to anybody about any part of this, including we welcome anybody who's interested in working with advising or wanted to be a part of this work. We have job opportunities open in the state of Connecticut. We're here. We're excited about this. And so you can certainly reach out to any of us at our emails, and we'd be happy to talk to you about anything that we've talked about today and or send you in the direction to look at some of the amazing jobs that are open in the state of Connecticut right now and to be a part of this work.
Awesome. And we'll put your contact info in our show notes for anyone that is interested. This has been a wonderful and informative chat, and I know we've learned so much from this already, so especially regarding the case management and the guided pathway policies. But thank you all so much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure having you on the podcast.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to Lisella, Michael, and Brian for talking to us about the implementation phase and also scaling Guided Pathways Advising, and to Michael Gomans for offering information on how technology is being utilized to support the project.
That will do it for us for episode 43. Check out our YouTube channel at Adventures in Advising. Subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast platform. And follow us on TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Advising Podcast. And also check out our website, adventuresinadvising.com. Until next time, this is your reminder that you are awesome, sending positive vibes your way. And as always, keep advising. Don't wanna